questions by commissioners?
I have a question for Ms. Gallo. Briefly, you know, without a dissertation level, we've spent a lot of time talking about the female Bicknell's thrush and her 8-acre required zone of protection. What do we know about the male and his larger, sorry for the anthropomorphic quality of that, and his larger area of activity requirements, and do we know that, in fact, he is not more sensitive than, in fact, the female to disruption of his habitat?
Well, that's a really good question. One of the complex things about Bicknell's thrush is this, and I think the panel earlier alluded to, that multiple males, multiple females, and one of the interesting things about males versus females is that the females have sort of exclusive territories and they tend not to overlap. And one of the reasons I didn't get into the male territories that are bigger is they do overlap each other. So you, I think the female, the illustration with the female territories is more clear-cut because they're not going to overlap, whereas the males, bigger territories, but they do overlap. So it does get very difficult to estimate density. Is a hard thing to do in this bird. I don't know if that's enough information. Or
so we don't know the degree to which the male would be affected by any habitat disruption because of that.
Right.
But the fact is we don't know.
We don't know. They do have, but it's good to acknowledge that, yes, they do have bigger territories than females.
I have a couple questions for Ms. Gallo, and they're all related to each other, and I apologize for asking them all at once, but it sort of helps me with my train of thought. The Bicknell's thrush has been spoken about as a bird of conservation concern. So the questions are, why isn't it an endangered species? What would trigger that designation? Not the sort of the political process, but what would have to happen to raise it to that level? And then in terms of the costs to the public, the taxpayers or, well, the public, the cost of preventing a bird or any species from being added to a list, an endangered species list, versus the cost of adding it, trying to protect it, trying to bring it back, and what is the success rate? So
okay.
They're all, again, I apologize for asking so many at a time. But
no, I wrote them down.
So why isn't it on the endangered and threatened list? And that's on the federal level, there is a huge list of species waiting to be put on the list, and they're all species that we don't have enough information on. We don't have enough money to fund getting the information we need, and it's also political that certain species take some arm twisting for the federal agencies. So there's a lot of reasons why it isn't listed federally. On the state level, one of the problems with Bicknell's is because it's restricted to these states in the Northeast, no individual state, the population hasn't dropped. We don't want to see it drop to a level that qualifies state listing. So for all the other most of the other birds we have, probably all the other birds we have, there are other states throughout the Northeast or throughout North America that have the bird. So that's not the case with this bird. Does that make sense? Where the endangered species legislation is designed to protect species when they get to very low numbers in our state. What would trigger the listing was one of your questions, and it would be a significant drop in numbers. And it does lead to your next question, and I don't have on the top of my head what the numbers are for the state in terms of triggering a listing for the state. Certainly its listing as a special concern species is a precursor to listing, and it is on the special concern list for the state. It would drop below a certain number, either a certain number of sites or a certain number of individuals, and that gets to the next point, which at that point, it's going to cost a lot more money. There's going to be a lot more regulations. One of the good things about keeping a species off the list is avoiding regulations, especially in light of developers and the things that they need to plan they don't want to see endangered species listing either. So our goal is to keep it off the list and save money and save time and make processes like this easier.
Madam Chair, I have questions of all three. Maybe I'll start with Dr. Publicover. You're the first person, at least today, to talk about the section of the CLEP that addresses high mountain resources. Other people have spent a lot of time talking about energy and wind power, but I know it's been addressed in pre-file testimony. But and you're suggesting that that this will set a precedent. If we were to approve this project, it will be the first wind project, if I understand you, that would allow for adverse impact on documented national communities in high mountain areas. Is that?
This is the first project that would have this degree of impact, not only, I think, in this rare natural community, but any documented rare natural community, you know, to significantly impact such a large percent of an occurrence. The only other wind projects that have been proposed in these habitats, one is Reddington and Black Knuckle, which was denied. The other is the Kibbe project, which has very minimal impact on this community. I think it might get into a very small bit of the edge. But certainly, there's been no wind project.
Could you speak up a little bit?
Oh, certainly, there's been no wind project that has had this degree of impact on a documented occurrence of a rare natural community.
And just so I'm clear, this documented impact surrounds the seven southern turbines and does not occur with regard to the eight northern turbines.
Yes,
is that correct?
The community, as it was mapped by the Natural Areas Program, does not. It actually, turbine eight gets into a little bit of the northern fringe, so it just barely gets into it. The southern the northern seven are outside of the mapped rare natural community.
Okay, thank you, Dave. Ms. Gallo, we were presented with testimony that the female range of the bicknell thrush is approximately 8 acres, and then you introduced 13 acres, I believe.
Yeah.
Could you talk about that a little bit? Like, where does the 8 acres come from? Where does the 13 acres come from?
Both come from Peter Vickery's pre-file testimony, where he and he cites a source in there. I don't have it off the top of my head, but and I don't have the page, but he refers to a range of 8. The range for female territory size is from 8 to 13.4 on, I believe it was a study area in Vermont. So I was using those two as kind of the two extremes, smaller to the larger for.
Well, given the significance of the Bicknell thrush, it would seem to me that the standard we should apply would be the 13.4. Is that unreasonable, do you think?
I don't think that's unreasonable, no. I mean, in my opinion, it's with this species and given the conservation concerns, I think we should be as liberal as we can on the conservation side.
But that 13.4 is supported in the literature.
Yes, it is.
It's not just speculation or
correct
visual experience or things like that. It's based on literature.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Also, this notion of edge effect, I understand the concept, certainly, but how far does the edge effect extend? I mean, could you talk a little bit more about what constitutes this edge effect and how it relates to the identification of habitat impact as presented by TransCanada?
Sure. I can do a little bit, and Dr. Publicover might want to jump in, too, because some of his testimony referred to that point. So we believe that the size of the roads that are created by the project and the pads themselves are different from a natural occurrence and a natural edge that would be created in the project area in the absence of the project. So the edge effects, when you get an opening, a road like that, you get a long linear opening through the through the habitat. You get light levels that penetrate into the forest. That changes and also changes at moisture level. You get invasive species that can grow along the road, then move into that area alongside the road, and all of those sort of small pieces add up to a change in habitat. It makes the forest habitat different than it would be without.
Are there any literature-based metrics to determine how far that extends under certain circumstances, or is this just?
Well, I'll tell you what I refer to in my testimony, which was up to, you know, I think there's some general reviews that say up to something like 400 feet for birds, not more than 400 feet. But I don't know.
I'm sorry, 400 feet per bird? I'm not understanding that.
For the bird literature, there are documented edge effects up to 400 feet from the edge.
Okay. And have you done any calculations to determine what that would, how that might amend or modify TransCanada's determination of the habitat limits?
We have not been able to do that, no. Not just out of lack of time and
would you care
primarily.
To speculate at all on what that might, percentage-wise?
I would easily say it would double it, and probably more than that.
Okay,
would you like to add, Dave?
Well, the map that first let me say that determination of edge effects is one of those things that quickly gets very complex. How you measure the edge effect depends on what you're measuring. Whether you're measuring the penetration of light, which may not go in as far as wind. Wind will go in farther, you know, if the edge is facing the prevailing winds as opposed to the wind coming from the forest side. But generally, you know, ranges are for, you know, the sort of the physical effect of edge effect is generally sometimes two to three tree heights. Oftentimes, I know Nature Conservancy in a lot of their studies of mapping of unfragmented forest blocks uses a buffer of about 100 meters around a road, which is 300 feet. Some of that has to do with how far, you know, sort of generalist edge predators like a raccoon might go into an interior forest. So it's highly dependent on, you know, what specific feature you're measuring. But if you assumed it was...
Well, which features are most critical for survival, healthy habitat of bicknell thrush?
Probably the blowdown.
Wind.
Wind, which is going to, again, the trees that are exposed, and much of this is going to be exposed to the strongest prevailing winds, which will, you know, likely cause increased blowdown. It's tough with bicknells because, and again, I don't leave that to Susan, but you know, creating blowdown areas actually creates, in some sense, creates the type of habitat the bicknells may prefer. So they may actually be attracted to the edge. But, in fact, that edge is going to be closer to the turbines, so by attracting them to the edge near the turbines, you're also maybe putting them at more risk of collision when they do their breeding displays. So it's fairly complex.
Now, given the breeding display and the mortality, the potential mortality, wouldn't that exist with the northern turbines as well as the southern turbines? Or the bicknell thrush in the southern range not travel north?
The vegetation surveys that TransCanada did for the areas in the where the northern turbines are going to be, there's just a couple, I believe there's two very small patches of suitable bicknell thrush habitat in that area. That doesn't mean if the proper conditions come along, a wind throw or an ice storm, that habitat wouldn't change. And the same goes for the southern part of the project area, you know, past the southern seven turbines, where I believe Peter Vickery mentioned earlier today that, you know, that there's all this abundant habitat down there. Well, and there's no birds. Well, there's habitat down there, but TransCanada surveys have shown there are bigger trees, taller trees, they're spaced wider apart. So there's no habitat there at the moment. You're right, both where the northern turbines are and south of the project area is going to likely evolve over time because of this dynamic nature and become habitat. But for us, it's drawing the line. And and because we support wind power, we do want to see these turbines on the landscape in the right places. And in our minds, the habitat up there qualifies as not creating undue adverse impacts for the species.
It's just fascinating to me that this puts you sort of in the horns of a dilemma.
It does.
I mean, adverse,
it's hard
adverse
to draw the line.
Undue adverse impact on the southern seven, but no undue on the northern eight, even though you've now testified that there will be some loss of bicknell habitat with the eight towers as well, the eight turbines.
I think the critical point is that the edge effect, you'll have the same types of edge effects for the northern eight turbines as you will for the southern, But the northern eight turbines are in a somewhat different community type. It's it's not the true subalpine fir that's the real habitat for Bicknell's thrush. It's more of just an upper slope spruce forest that could potentially contain some Bicknells, but is not is not really considered the critical habitat for the species. But certainly the edge effects are going to be there, but the species that might be affected are not as critical.
Okay. All right. Do you agree with Mr. Vickery's statement that, I forget what the terminology he used, is that the loss of, there was no consequence to the loss of 8 acres of Bicknell thrush habitat, because that's the habitat that would be habituated, I guess, by
right.
a female, the range of a female.
Right. No, I disagree with that statement. I think equating those eight acres lost to one bird is not accurate. As you saw, those three, where the habitat is lost is in three, the 8 acres is in three slices. I don't know of any bird that has a territory that's three slices along the edge. I think it's very likely, I can't speculate it, but if I was to speculate, it would be more than one for sure. It would probably be three. With the data we have, it could be five, it could be eight. I disagree strongly with that statement, and I don't believe the standard is up in it for LURC and for this project is an impact on the population.
Thank you. Kathy, just Ms. Johnson, again, I find your testimony, you have the same undue adverse impact, scenic impact for the southern seven, but not for the northern eight, even though there will be impact.
Yes.
And I guess I'm having a little bit of difficulty. And then you go on to suggest that were we to approve the northern eight, you would still suggest that we attach permit conditions to mitigate for visual impact. And I'm just not sure what that means. I mean, do we put up sheets in front of – I mean, I'm not sure what you're implying. You're talking about – please, just explain what you mean by mitigate. What would you see as a condition requiring mitigation for scenic impact?
Well, we believe that the adverse impacts from the eight northern turbines, that there would be some adverse impacts, but we don't believe that they rise to the level of undue. But because there will be adverse impacts to avoid, to mitigate for those or as a condition of the permit, we would suggest that some other scenic areas be protected as a way of ensuring that similar types of scenic areas. In my written testimony, I suggest a couple places, Pisgah Mountain or Sisk Mountain itself, the peak and the part of the ridge that the southern part of the ridge would potentially be appropriate areas. We're not saying those are the only
areas. So off-site, in-kind mitigation.
To protect the similar kinds of values is what we would be looking. So to the extent that we're losing scenic values, some scenic values as a result of the eight towers, protect similar kind of scenic value.
Okay, thank you.
Anybody else have any questions?
Gwen, I have.
Yes.
I have just one quick one about artificial edge. In the critical habitat that you're referring to, the Bicknell thrush habitat, to your knowledge, have there been any woods operations, woods roads that would have created artificial edge in the past, or have they been off limits? I can't tell from...
I'm not getting the question. There's
a clear cut very close to the area. I don't think it's in it. But,
yeah.
And there's woods roads... maybe yes. In the past, I can't tell whether there have been or not, which would have created the artificial edge you're saying is not the same as a natural artificial edge. So I just wonder if that area has been subjected to that before.
My understanding is that areas near the project area, yes, where there anytime there's logging operations, yes, you're creating, with either logging roads or the cutting itself, you were creating edge effects. Absolutely.
So, okay. All right. Thanks.
Okay. I guess I have a question, too, for you.
Sure.
Mr. Vickery commented about the Bicknell's thrush and use of regenerated forest areas for habitat, breeding habitat. What is your reaction to that or your experience with that?
I think that that is a lot. That is speculation that has not been borne out in documentation. I think if there was this untapped habitat, that we would hear about it from the state. We would hear about it from the folks at Vermont Center for Eco Studies. I understand that. I agree that there are birds, Bicknell's thrush, using lower elevation clear cuts in Nova Scotia and north and east of us in Canada. They do use lower elevations forests up there. I think there are occasional observations of Bicknell's thrush in clear cuts here and there in the state of Maine. I wouldn't deny that it's an occasional occurrence. I don't believe that there is a vast acreage of there out there of untapped Bicknell's thrush. I think it would be much easier if that were the case, and I don't believe it is the case.
Okay, thank you. And one other question I have for Dr. Publicover. I think something that you just said a few minutes ago about that if we were to approve this project, we would be setting the bar too low with respect to, or setting a precedent. And I'm wondering, I think that you probably have looked at other areas in this. I mean, if we set that bar a little bit lower, I mean, how many viable wind power projects are out there? Has anybody actually looked at that? Viable, where we don't impact some of the things, you know, what you're proposing here that we should not impact?
Yeah, we've certainly looked, done a fair bit of looking at this, mapped ridgelines with class 4 wind across the state, figured out how much of that is in the expedited, how much is not. There's a relatively small number of places within the expedited area that are above 3,000 feet. You know, this is one of them, Coburn Mountain, which is actually part of which is within the area where wind power would be allowed under the Plum Creek easement. And if you look at satellite photos of Coburn Mountain, it's pretty much clear-cut all the way to the top, perhaps West Kennebago. But in terms of areas within the expedited, and then other areas that may be potentially close to the Appalachian Trail in an organized town like Carrabassett Valley, which would have their own set of impacts. So in terms of the amount of wind resource that's in the expedited area, the amount of it that's above 3,000 feet is pretty limited. Most of the high mountain areas are outside of the expedited. Much of the northern part of the Boundary Mountains, the Kennebago Divide area, much of the western high mountains. So, and another point is that when we looked at the areas we mapped, and we did this, probably 4 or 5 years ago, when it was thought that a class 4 wind resource was really what you needed, sites that we did not pick out and did not even evaluate, Stetson, Mars Hill, we did include, Rollins, Oakfield, none of those showed up because they didn't show up in the wind resource maps, but those are proving to be viable wind resource sites. So I think the wind resource data that people have presented and looking at, I think people are finding that some of these lower elevation ridge lines that may be class 3 winds, are economically viable and certainly have far, they're much more likely to have second growth, cut over forest, roads on them, and I think there's probably more viable sites out there than are thought, but they're lower elevation. They may not have the wind resource. It may be that a Stetson type project only generates a third of the energy per turbine as this type of project. But I'd much rather see 10 acres of second growth young common hardwood forest used for wind power project as opposed to 1 acre of a rare high elevation subalpine forest.
Okay, thank you. Anything else? Any questions by staff? government agencies, TransCanada.
Madam Chair, we have one procedural request, which is since the consolidated parties and the Friends of the Boundary Mountain didn't testify, one right after another, would like to reallocate. We have 20 minutes for cross for each, would like to do 35 minutes cross for the consolidated parties and reserve 5 minutes for the Friends of the Boundary Mountain.
Okay. Let's look at that.
And just for the sake of time, because we are moving, again, Scott Anderson for TransCanada, what I'm asking Kelly to do is hand out some copies of some items that we are likely to ask Susan Gallo to comment on during cross-examination so that you all have them and we're not
That's great. That's good. Juliet, can you just repeat what you asked?
Yes, we were allocated 20 minutes cross for Friends of the Boundary Mountain, 20 minutes cross for the consolidated parties. We request 35 minutes cross for the consolidated parties and reserve 5 minutes for the Friends of the Boundary Mountain.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Ms. Gallo. My name is Scott Anderson, and on behalf of TransCanada, I have some questions to ask you about your testimony that you've provided today.
Sure.
So you're providing your testimony today on behalf of the three consolidated interveners, including Maine Audubon, AMC, and NRCM. Is that correct?
Correct.
And you've cited some peer-reviewed papers in your testimony, and some of these names have come up. So I just want to walk through a couple of names of folks that you cite in your testimony. Some of these folks have also provided testimony before this commission on Bicknell Special recently to make sure we're kind of understanding who the universe of experts are in this issue.
Sure.
Certainly, I think you would agree that both Chris Rimmer and Kent McFarland at the Vermont Center for Eco Studies are widely considered as experts on Bicknell's thrush. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
And are you familiar with the work of David Evers at the Biodiversity Research Institute and some of the work that he's done on mapping and surveying of Bicknell's thrush?
Only just recently. We just received, I'm assuming you're referring to this recent study he did for TransCanada?
Well, both that and generally the work that Mr. Evers has done. You would agree that he is someone who is competent to kind of talk about Bicknell's issues. It's okay if you're not familiar with his work. That's fine.
I'm very
too.
Familiar with Dave Evers. I would not consider his work I would not consider him a Bicknell's thrush expert. I would consider him a toxics expert. Yes.
Okay. Great. And also, you may be familiar. I'm not sure with Jeff Wells and some of the work that he's done on Bicknell's. Are you familiar with his work, and would you consider him someone qualified to testify on issues regarding Bicknell's?
Yes, because of his experience with the boreal forest, sure.
And are you aware of the fact that Mr. Wells provided testimony on behalf of NRCM as their expert on Bicknell's in the Black Knubble proceeding?
Yes.
Okay, and were you, in preparing for your testimony, were you able to review some of the testimony that Maine Audubon and NRCM has provided to this commission recently on issues of Bicknell's thrush?
You're talking about specifically Reddington and Black Knubble?
Or the Kibbe project as well.
Or Kibbe, yep. I tried. I tried the best I could.
Excellent. Great. Thanks. And in your work, have you actually engaged in any surveying work or specific study or published papers regarding Bicknell's thrush?
No.
So is it fair to say that the testimony that you're presenting to us today is based on your review of work that has been done by a number of other individuals?
That's correct.
And then finally, I think Tom Hodgman's name comes up as one of the co-authors of one of the sites, and I think you would probably agree that, his work that he's been doing with IF&W, that he is certainly familiar with the Bicknell's, it's the current struggles it's dealing with, and is able to kind of comment on Bicknell's issues as well, correct?
Yes, within the constraints of state agency, yes, he is.
Okay, great. Hopefully he's not here to hear the constraints.
Oh, he would. I don't think you'd have a problem with that.
Great. And as you had heard from Mr. Vickery's testimony and reading Mr. Vickery's testimony, Peter has suggested that regenerating fir spruce forest provides suitable habitat. My understanding from just some recent back and forth with the commission is that you don't agree that has been proven yet, or that it's widely understood that Bicknells will use regenerating clear-cut forests?
In Maine? Are we talking Maine specifically? Or in
anywhere where they're, you know, within their kind of breeding range?
I think there are places in their breeding range, yes, where they will use that more than in other places.
And is this area in Maine specific in some way that you would think it wouldn't be the type of area that regenerating fir forests would provide potential habitat?
Well, it's Bicknells follow a latitudinal gradient from the southern end of the range to the northern end of the range. So they move down in latitude as they move north. Mm-hmm. So in Quebec and New Brunswick, where there's logging in those lower elevations where they are, there's going to be more of that habitat.
Just because we have very little time, is there something about the regenerating forest in the area of the project that would cause you to conclude that it doesn't kind of fit the model for that type of habitat for breeding Bicknells?
It would have to, in my opinion, in that portion, based on the latitude of where we are in the Bicknells range, it would have to be higher elevation regenerating forest.
And I believe that you had testified that there really aren't any studies out there that kind of address the use of regenerating clear-cut forest by Bicknells thrush. Is that true in response to a question a moment ago?
In Maine, correct, for Maine.
And I'd like to bring your attention to watch list, the 2007 watch list, which I think is at the top of your pile. This was the watch list that you refer to in your testimony, correct?
Right.
And I just want to bring your attention down on the first page to an area that I've highlighted, and would just ask you to read that to the commission.
Sure. More recently, Bicknell's thrush has taken advantage of areas disturbed by timber harvesting, ski trail and road construction, and other human activities.
So certainly it's a position of National Audubon when they're identifying threats to this that Bicknell's thrush are utilizing these kind of areas.
I assume if that's what taken advantage of means, I would say yes.
Okay. And if I could have you turn to the third page in that, isn't it also true, and there's been some significant work done by Rimmer on ski trail and the impacts of ski trails on Bicknell's thrush, correct?
Correct.
And isn't it true that Rimmer has actually concluded that when you've got that kind of human disturbance, that not only under certain circumstances do those provide habitat, but the edges along those ski trails, you will find a greater density of nesting sites than deeper into the forest? Isn't that true?
I believe that's true for ski trails. I wouldn't jump from ski trails to wind turbine developments, especially given the time of year when ski trails are full of people and the weekly sort of maintenance and disturbance that a wind turbine site will have.
But there's been some extensive discussion here about the edge effects, and Dr. Publicover has also weighed on this. And although edge effects as a general rule is something that you look at when it affects habitat and the critters that are in that habitat. For Bicknells, the edge effect analysis is slightly different, correct? Because there's some benefits to Bicknells due to that edge effect.
Yes, you could say that.
Okay. And also, if I can turn your attention to this third page, I just want to point out down towards the bottom of the third page, the paragraph that starts since 2003.
Yep.
And this part of National Audubon is talking about some of the conservation strategies and the challenges with helping to preserve this this species. I'm just going to read from the second sentence. Conservation efforts and research are difficult to conduct for this species under natural conditions, but power line and radio tower cuts, commercial ski activities, and wind power stations may provide access and significant opportunities for habitat management. Do you see that?
I do.
And do you agree with National Audubon that actually some of these human disturbed areas can provide those kind of opportunities?
On a small scale, yes.
Okay. Also, just kind of going back to this issue of, do we have any evidence that Bicknells are using these regenerating fir forests, and I think you had mentioned that there's very little study on that. What I'd like to do is draw your attention to a document that's been labeled TransCanada Exhibit 13, and this is the testimony of Jeffrey Wells on behalf of NRCM in the Black Nubble proceeding, which you said that you had reviewed in preparation for providing testimony in this matter.
Excuse me, is this in the packet you gave me or not?
Yes, it should be. It may be the last item at the bottom. And it says on the top, pre-filed testimony of Pete Dittesheim, because Mr. Wells, Dr. Wells' testimony was attached to Mr. Dittesheim's testimony. And if I could draw your attention to tab number 2, which I think I've marked as number 2, which is on page 7 of Dr. Wells' testimony. Please let me know when you've got that.
Yep.
So down toward, this is Dr. Wells testifying on behalf of NRCM and Black Nubble. He was asked to testify on Bicknell's Thrush and the impacts of that project on Bicknell's Thrush. And he is noting here at the bottom of this page that in Maine and adjacent Canadian provinces, Bicknell's Thrush have been found with increasing frequency in regenerating clear cuts typically dominated by balsam fir or with a significant component of balsam fir. And he cites some studies, including Nixon and Rimmer, that have found that's the case, correct?
I believe the Nixon paper focuses on Canada as well, and he's probably referring to his personal observation, because as you can see, there's a list of references following that sentence. Mm-hmm. That would be my guess.
All right, so this goes to this issue of whether or not these regenerating fir in this area are somehow less suitable than regenerating fir in other locations.
Correct.
But Mr. Wells, in his testimony here, has actually found that when you consider the amount of what is considered traditional habitat, you can see on the bottom of page 7, he's noting there's about 83,000 acres of traditional subalpine habitat in Maine for Bicknell's Thrush. Do you see that?
Yeah.
And then you kind of flip over and onto page 8, and he notes that, well, when you incorporate this regenerating fir forest in the state of Maine, that there may be as much as 98,000 additional acres that fall within this category. Do you see that?
I do.
So is it fair to say that NRCM's position in these prior proceedings and Jeff Wells, who we've kind of concluded, someone who knows something about Bicknells, has identified that in Maine there's extensive habitat that's available for Bicknell's Thrush?
No, I disagree with that statement.
Okay.
I believe you're correct, 83,000 of predicted Bicknell's Thrush habitat. Mm-hmm. That 98,000 acres occurs to regenerating spruce fir. There is no statement in that paper that says that 98,000 additional acres is potential Bicknell's Thrush habitat.
But Dr. Wells concluded that it was potential habitat in his testimony, correct?
Yes, and I would disagree with the conclusion
of
his
fine.
Testimony.
And one other thing, you testified in your pre-filed testimony that impacts to all Bicknell's Thrush must be avoided, and I think what you're talking about is both the existing, which is this 88 acres, and some of the potential Bicknell's Thrush habitat on the ridgeline, correct?
Correct.
So I guess the question is, you're not suggesting that you can't impact a single acre of this habitat, are you?
I am not, and I think everybody reads their testimony after they read it, and I caught that, and And no, I don't believe that every acre of ground is sacred for Bicknell's Thrush.
And in your testimony in the conclusions where you have concluded there is an undue adverse effect, you're only looking at the habitat on the ridgeline, correct? You're not factoring in what potential regenerating fir forest habitat may be available for the species, correct?
Correct, since we don't know how much regenerating forest around the project area is suitable, I don't think that it's possible to assess that.
All right, but on the site visit and in Mr. Vickery's testimony, you've seen some evidence of the different stages of regenerating forests extensively in the project area, correct?
Yes, I disagree with several of the exhibits that Dr. Vickery showed.
Okay.
The low elevation clear cuts, I think that's stretching it very far to say that those valley bottom regenerating clear cuts are Bicknell's Thrush habitat.
And finally, you're familiar with Dr. Wells' testimony on behalf of NRCM. And in that situation we had, in that case, NRCM was supporting the project. There were approximately 64 acres of direct impacts as compared to the 8 that we're talking about here. And isn't it true that in the Black Knobble proceeding, Dr. Wells concluded that those 64 acres would be inconsequential to the breeding bicknells?
I believe that was his conclusion.
All right. So, today you're providing testimony on behalf of NRCM to this commission and have concluded that the impact of 8 acres necessitates a denial of a permit for this project.
Yes, I think that there are a lot of things that went along with that Reddington Black Knobble project that were in cooperation
No, I appreciate that, but you disagree with Dr. Wells.
I do disagree with Dr. Wells, yes.
Thank you very much, Ms. Gunn.